This evening we're looking at chapter 9 of 2 Corinthians, the first five verses. 2 Corinthians chapter 9, the first five verses. For as touching the ministering to the saints, it is superfluous for me to write to you. For I know the forwardness of your mind, for which I boast of you to them of Macedonia, that Achaia was ready a year ago. And your zeal hath provoked very many. Yet have I sent the brethren, lest our boasting of you should be in vain in this behalf, that, as I said, you may be ready. Lest, haply, if they of Macedonia come with me and find you unprepared, we should be ashamed in this same confident boasting. Therefore I thought it necessary to exhort the brethren that they would go before unto you and make up beforehand your bounty, whereof ye had noticed before, that the same might be ready as a matter of bounty and not as of covetousness. Circumstances change from day to day for me and for you. And circumstances change from age to age. The Corinthians had their problems. I think it's maybe an undeserved attitude that we have toward those people that we oftentimes cite or look at the Corinthians with the idea that here were a group of people who were constantly beset with all sorts of problems and confusion, and that if you want to look at a church that had a lot of trouble and many problems and yet survived, look at the Corinthians. You know, as I've studied these books and tried to study them as intently and closely as I possibly could, I've come to love them. I view them differently. I know they have their problems. They had their problems, and yet they were the kind of people who had great big hearts. They were people who would respond, and they were people who had a zeal for the work of God. And how can you not love people like these? They did have problems. And don't we all? Some of these problems that the Corinthians had were unusual and perhaps unique to them. A few of them were. Many of them were common everyday problems in the sense that they reflect our weaknesses. They reflect the things that we find troublesome. They reflect things that we perhaps have not done as well as we should. We can see ourselves reflected so many times in the problems that the Corinthians had with fleshly and carnal things. So when we look at them and look at the problems, not a matter of condemnation. More than anything else, it's a process of learning. We'd like to use the things that Paul wrote them, and I'm sure conclusions that they came to on their own and said as they read the letters of Paul, Paul's right. This is the way it should have been handled. This is what we should have done. Yes, I can see that this is the kind of thing that our Lord would have advised us to do or not to do. And in these verses that I've read this evening, I find four great truths. And by that, I simply mean principles that were derived, that we can derive from the experiences of these people. We can participate in truth and find from these people strength and encouragement and what I referred to this morning as sound advice. And these truths and principles do not change. And so it's of great benefit when we can find them and make some sort of application to our own life and perhaps to our own church. In verse 1, I think I can see a statement of principle there that is helpful to all of us, and that is that good people don't need continual scoldings. It's not the intention of Paul to continually scold and to correct the people at Corinth. He says, "For as touching the ministering to the saints, it is superfluous for me to write to you." Now, he has written to them about these saints who were in distress, and he has mentioned it casually, he has mentioned it pointedly, and now as he concludes his writing about them, I think Paul is saying, it's not necessary for me to keep on bringing this to your attention. It is not necessary for me to keep finding fault with any attitude you may have had. It's not necessary to keep scolding you about this. It's not necessary to keep encouraging you about this. This word superfluous means just more than enough. It seems that Paul said, I've mentioned it, I've brought it to your attention, and now I know that you will do what God wants you to do. I think we all tire of correcting people, though our children would never believe us, that we're oftentimes don't correct them simply because we're just weary of it. I mean, how many times do you have to say, clean up your room? How many times do you say, did you make up your bed? How many times do you say, did you brush your teeth? And they say, yes, I did. When? 3 months ago. Do you mean brush my teeth every day? Is that what you, oh, I thought you meant, you know, just whenever the green begins to show is be adequate. You know, we tire of continually saying, you know, I think that pastors tire of saying, you know, we need to come to church. We need to give our attention to giving. We need to give. We're behind. I know there's not anything that worries and wearies me any more than just having continually ding-dong on something that ought to be done just out of a heart of love and appreciation and because it's the right thing to do. Sometimes we get into that situation and we just become people who are just involved in constantly reminding people, don't do this and don't do that. Be sure you do this. Be sure you don't do that. And I think maybe Paul sort of reaches a point here where he says, and it's really not necessary. It's enough is enough. I've said what I should say, and you're grown people and you're intelligent people. And as we often say, a word to the wise is sufficient. I don't think that it shows disinterest. I don't think it shows half-heartedness and unconcern when we finally say, what more can we say? What else can we add to our warnings and our pleadings or even to our witnessing? I think Jesus recognized this kind of situation, although it was far more dramatic than ours, when he told the 70 who had gone out two by two as initial witnesses to the nation of Israel, if people do not hear you, then when you leave, just dust your feet as a signal or in emblem of the fact that you have done what you could, and further worrying and further witnessing would be unfruitful, and you go to another town and see if they'll receive your message. The rich man who said, I have five brothers, was told by the Lord, they have Moses and the prophets, or they have the written word literally, is what Jesus meant, and that's an adequate witness to those people. You know, sometimes out of love we warn of danger, and we never tire of that perhaps, but it's the just the common things of our Christian endeavor that we might find ourselves involved in to the point that we'd grow weary of it and say, well, enough is enough. Paul said, I've done it, and isn't it great? It's a wonderful experience when just a hint will set people in motion to do all the things that they need to do. And I think more than anything, this is what Paul is saying. I've said it, I've written it, we've talked about it, you have mentioned it, and now it's settled, do it. And then another truth that I see is contained in verse 2, and that is that zeal can be contagious. That zeal oftentimes is contagious. Paul said, for I know the forwardness of your mind, for which I boast of you to them of Macedonia, that Achaia, that is the churches of Achaia, of which the Corinthians were a part of that particular region, that Achaia was ready a year ago, and your zeal hath provoked very many. Paul said, I have told people that a year ago, you people were ready, you were willing, and you were excited about doing something for the poor saints at Jerusalem. I know your forwardness, and this word means eagerness, goodwill. They displayed an eagerness to do the will of God, and your zeal hath provoked very many. Your zeal hath provoked very many. The word provoke means to arouse, to excite. It even has in it the idea of irritate. And I thought, I think in my ministry I have seen persons in a church whose zeal was such condemnation to all the rest of us that it was irritating to be around people who had such zeal. Have you ever felt that way? That someone in the church, a family or someone is so zealous, and their zeal embarrasses us because we don't seem to have that much zeal to do the work of God, that to be around them and to hear them talk and to try to keep up with them and doing the work of God, it sort of serves as an irritant. I think maybe that's what was happening here in this situation. It aroused these people. Paul was using it to arouse them, and maybe even their zealousness had in it the power of irritation. I remember my brother, who lives in Florida and pastors a church there, told about one of his members who was an airline pilot, and they were in a building program, and he said, I woke up one night and I heard this hammering, and I said, I looked at the clock and it's 3:00 in the morning. And he said, I couldn't imagine what on earth was going on. And he said, I finally slipped in some clothes and house shoes and walked to the church, and lights were on, and this fellow was just hammering and sawing and building and working and humming and singing. And I found out it was the pilot who'd come in, and he hadn't got to work on the building, and he felt like he ought to, and he was building. I rather think maybe, I asked Stan, what did you do? And he said, what could you do? I just got a hammer and helped him. But I think maybe it sort of irritated Stan, you know. Here's this man's zeal that's gotten me out of bed. He wants to work, and I can't lie over there and sleep while he works, not just for the noise, but because of my feeling obligated to do what I ought to do. And so his zeal served as an irritant. And this kind of thing is what Paul is saying. Your zeal has been contagious. It has created zeal in other people. And I know all of us are aware of the fact that the opposite is true too. Oftentimes our frustrations and our depression serve as a depressant to other people. When we get down, and that spreads perhaps more quickly than our getting up does. But we need to understand that our attitude, the work of God, influences other people. And our zeal can be contagious. And our depression can be contagious as well. And then in verses 3 and 4, I really didn't know how to put this as I studied. And I remembered some of the older television programs where one man said something to this effect, it ain't bragging, it's fact. Now that is something of what Paul was saying in verses 3 and 4, and that is boasting is not bragging if you do it. Now Paul said, I've boasted about you people. I have literally bragged on you people, and now if you don't do what I have said you were willing to do and anxious to do and competent to do, then I'm going to be found a braggart, a boaster, an empty boaster. The word means a subject of literally boasting. The word ready means to make ready, near or at hand. And what he's saying is, I have told people that a year ago you were zealous to help the poor saints at Jerusalem. Now get the money ready, that is, get it where we can put our hands on it. Because to talk about what you're willing to do is not adequate. I have to show people what you have done. Now it is time for past tense. It can no longer be good intentions. Now it must be money at hand. The offering, Paul refers to it here, is bounty. It is time to put the bounty in a bag. I've got to have something when I come, Paul said, or we're going to be embarrassed. If the Corinthians did not have their offering ready, Paul said it would create shame. And this word shame is a word that means the feeling that comes from doing a dishonorable act. Paul said, you're going, and he mentions here, not necessarily you in this parenthetical statement in the fourth verse, that we may not, that we say not ye, in other words, and find you unprepared, we should be ashamed. He says, I'm saying we and not ye. He didn't say you would be the ones who'd be particularly embarrassed, but I would be the one who was embarrassed. You know, when we speak of our confidence in someone or the ability of someone, and then that person does or doesn't do what we've talked about or assured others that they're able to do, it can create an embarrassing situation for us. I guess early in my ministry, I learned that. I had an uncle who lived in Walnut Ridge, and he had to come to Little Rock for a water commissioner's meeting. And I had a room and had extra place for him to stay, and he stayed with me. And that evening, I said, would you like to go to a revival meeting that's near here and hear a certain preacher preach? He said, well, I don't know. What do you think? And I said, he's a great preacher. I'm telling you, I've never heard anything like it. It's just fantastic. You're going to really? He said, okay, you know, sure, I'll go. And we went, and there's a huge crowd of people. Singing was good. The evangelist stood up and looked around and said, well, how many of you are saved? And all this, you know, ocean of hands were raised. And he said, how many of you are lost? And he looked around and said, there's not a hand. He said, I had an evangelistic message prepared. No use wasting ammunition. And he read a few lines and said a few things about being faithful and sat down. Boy, was I ever embarrassed. Because I knew what this man could do. And there I'd talked about how well he preached, how great a preacher he was. And he didn't preach. He just said a few words. And I think this is the kind of idea Paul has. Paul said, I have talked about how generous you people are, how forward you are, how anxious you are, how willing you are, that even a year ago you had said, sure, we want to help, we're anxious to help. Paul said, now it's time to put that in a bag that we can pick up and look at and use. It's a bounty. And then in verse 5, I think this is a truth that that most of us are aware of, and that is that covetousness can create unnecessary pressure. Now, there are some religions that solve the problem of covetousness by simply saying, we won't possess anything. we will impose abject poverty on ourselves. The Hindu says, I will have nothing but just my clothing, and I will beg from door to door, and therefore I will solve the problem of covetousness. That's kind of the same attitude that Confucius had when he said the way to stop thievery is for no one to covet what they owned. That way no one could steal, since you were willing to give whoever wanted what you had because you didn't claim it as your own. You were not covetous. Therefore, people would not have to break in and steal anything. Just leave the doors open. They'd wander in and get what they wanted. Then there'd be no thieves. I don't know. Some way it doesn't work with me, does it? I think somebody would find a way to steal anyway, even if, you know, just everybody wandered around getting whatever they wanted, but it'd be a sorry way to do business. That's not the answer. The idea that if we just simply gave away everything we possessed, then there would be no covetousness. If we had nothing, how could we covet? If we just disciplined ourselves to accept that as a fact. Paul said, therefore I thought it necessary to exhort the brethren that they would go before unto you and make up beforehand your bounty, whereof ye had noticed before, that the same might be ready. Now notice, that is the money, this collection, might be ready as a matter of bounty. That's a rather peculiar word. It's translated a lot of places, blessing. That it might be a matter of blessing and not as covetousness. Now here's Paul's idea. Here's his thinking. He said, if we come into your presence, and I think he's talking about coming to the church, and this money is not ready, it's not in a bag, and it's not prepared for the messengers to take it and proceed to Jerusalem, they will accuse you of being covetous because you've held on to your money just as long as you could. And therefore you've given the impression of covetousness. And Paul said that would be an embarrassing thing for me, especially, to learn that you had to, that when you came together, you had to wait and linger. It took a period of time for these messengers to finally accumulate what you had said that you would give. So covetousness robs us of the joy that we may have in giving. You know, it doesn't mean you don't give. It's possible to be covetous and yet give, but being covetous and giving with a covetous attitude takes away the joy and the blessing of giving. You know, there are a lot of trite sayings about people and how stingy they are, but I have known stingy people. I mean, just really stingy people who gave, but it created a rather intense inward pain. You can just see it just sort of, oh, just there it goes, you know. Man, what if I could keep that? Look at all the things I could buy, and the pain is sort of eased from every ounce of their body when they gave their offering. Paul said, I don't want you people to appear to be that kind of people. Take the offering. Let people give. Have it at hand, just ready to pick up, because that'll be a good testimony of your forwardness and of your zeal and of the fact that you didn't covet it and try to hang on to it just as long as you possibly could. I want us to stand and sing a hymn of invitation this evening, and as we sing, I hope these truths have helped you. They've been meaningful to you. If you're here this evening and you're lost, as I said this morning, there's no hope outside of Jesus Christ. He is the one who gave himself on the cross that his sinlessness might accrue to our account when we trust him, and we might be found in him, not having our unrighteousness really, but be found in his righteousness. If you're here this evening and you need to come for baptism or to transfer your membership, you do that as we sing.